This is Barbara Levin. She is the head of the Massachusetts Board of Registered Nursing, and she's going to talk about a case study with a cervical spine surgery complication and the legal issues surrounding it, where a relatively young man, I believe in his 50s, died because of some negligence and poor communication. So she highlights the importance of charting in real time, notifying the doctor as soon as you have a concern, and just kind of how to CYA, basically. So this is similar to the other one that talked about culture of safety, but she highlights some different things. So give it a listen. I think it's some good information.
And I always feel that it's important to tell a story. We learn so much from a story. And the story happens to be is a clinical story, and then I'm going to talk about some of the legal issues. We will talk about standards of nursing care. I'm also going to present information about audit trails, because I think in this day and age, it's important for you to know what is an audit trail, what does it look like when it's printed, and how it can help you later on down the road, or perhaps going against you. So I want to begin by telling you a story of a lovely 54-year-old gentleman who was a husband, a father, and a grandfather, who was actually admitted to the hospital to have a routine surgery on his neck. And many of you know that neck pain is a commonly reported pathology in the United States. It's suggested that up to 54% of the population will actually have neck pain in their lifetime. Gender seems to affect the incidence of neck pain. Females are 1.38% or times more likely to have neck pain when compared to their male counterparts. Although cervical degenerative complaints tend to be common, true cervical radicular complaints tend to be actually much lower. Less than 3% of patients presenting with cervical neck pain actually require surgical intervention. Although anterior cervical discectomy infusion is actually one of the most commonly performed spinal surgical procedures, there are inherent risks that go along with this, and they are not limited to epidural hematomas, C5 nerve palsy, recurrent laryngeal nerve palsy, dural tear, esophageal perforations, brachial plexus, blindness, vascular injury, and even quadriplegia. So, old man, whom I will call Mr. A, he had a history of weakness in his biceps, grade 4 out of 5, and some sensory loss at C6 and 7 with throbbing. His MRI actually showed some disc space collapse at C5 and 6, C6 and 7. He was admitted to the hospital for planned surgery. He had an anterior cervical discectomy infusion, and he had a right incision, anterior incision. He went to the PACU from 1341 to 1526. This is actually a picture of his x-ray after the fusion. Now, the cervical spine comprises of 7 vertebral bodies, just a little reminder. C1 and C2 articulation, it doesn't actually have an intervertebral disc. The cervical spine is very richly innervated with vascular structures, including the vertebral artery, coursing just lateral to the discogenic areas of the discs. The anterior surgical approach is commonly used with patients, and is commonly used with those patients who have degenerative disc disease, cervical radiculopathy, and even cervical myelopathy. It's also used for removal of tumors. Minor yet frequent postoperative issues from that approach can be mild to moderate dysphagia due to mobilization of the trachea and the esophagus. That certainly makes sense for moving up the structures. Dysphonia can occur, and it can be concerning if there's an increase laryngeal nerve. Okay, just a little announcement for you. Apparently my handouts were not uploaded. I'm sorry about that. The Smith-Buckland team said that they will be captured and loaded. I also want you can have my email address, which is beginning and end here. You're welcome to take my email address if you want to contact me for them. So I apologize for that. Less common complications of these approaches are retropharyngeal hematomas. If this occurs, then your airway compromise can quickly occur, and identification of this is emergent. You need to have an emergent decompression of that hematoma. Posterior approaches, sometimes they're used to reinforce the multi-level anterior cervical surgery or unstable traumatic injuries or even lateral herniated discs. So this gentleman went to the PACU and he was having 10 out of 10 pain. And the nurse was evaluating him, gave a report to the floor nurse, and he was discharged to the floor at 16:10. Upon his arrival to the floor, he complained of sore throat. Now, you and I know that after patients have had general anesthesia, oftentimes we will hear of a complaint of a sore throat. And we monitor that, and we may give them some throat lozenges or give them some cool liquids to drink. By 16:15, he actually had a non-productive cough. His pain was a 9, and he was medicated with morphine. I also want to point out to you that his blood pressure was very elevated at 186 over 108, and he did not have a history of hypertension. And we know that pain can certainly increase your blood pressure. So it certainly warranted watching and communicating this to the physicians. His blood pressure came down just a little bit after medicated with morphine. And at 17:44, he was still having a difficult time, and the staff administered Valium to him in a PO form. He had a very difficult time swallowing that pill. He was given another dose of morphine. He still complained of neck pain, and the nursing staff evaluated him and said that his respiratory rate was regular and it was unlabored. They had at this facility a 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. and a 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. nurse. So the 7 p.m. nurse came in, she took a report, and she documented within the medical record breath sounds of all lobes are clear. I just want to point out to you, and we're going to talk about it a little later, that she actually testified at trial that she never listened to the breath sounds, but she documented they were normal. So on a point with that, if you're documenting something that you're not doing, it certainly decreases your credibility. It was documented in the medical record that the wife was at the bedside feeding him ice cream, and the family was actually explaining that he was just having little licks off of a spoon. He wasn't eating a full ice cream. By 20:00, he was complaining again of a sore throat, and 10 minutes later, he was stating that he couldn't breathe. He had already received a throat lozenger. The nurse testified that he was having some difficulty breathing, and the wife was requesting, "Can you please call a doctor? Something is not right with my husband because he's having a hard time breathing." The charge nurse was informed that this patient was having some respiratory issues, and the physician was informed. Both of them directed the nurse to call the respiratory therapist. The respiratory therapist came, evaluated the patient, and administered a nebulizer treatment. During the nebulizer treatment and even afterwards, Mr. A was complaining and still having a hard time breathing. 10 minutes later, he started coughing, and he was coughing up some bloody secretions. He stated and kind of whispered that he felt like he was choking to death. The nurse said, "I think I'm going to give you another Valium." And the patient stated, and the wife, "He can't possibly swallow another pill." He didn't want to swallow a pill, so with that, she administered more morphine. At 21:50, the nurse did call the physician, and she was informing him of some of the symptoms. And When we talk about communication, I really encourage you that when you're doing your documentation in the medical record, write which physician did you call, because if you say called physician or called house officer, if your practice is ever in question, you want to make sure that it's documented as to actually who you contacted. By 2200, he was complaining of shortness of breath, but they were stating that he had no visible distress. He was unable to swallow, and they called the respiratory therapist again. The respiratory therapist noted that he had a non-productive cough, he was short of breath, and she actually checked his O2 sats, which were normal, 98%. A short time later, nursing noted that he was sitting upright in bed. He was having some soreness now in his upper back and his shoulders, and he was reporting that any time he tried to swallow, it was making him cough. So that's a sign that this patient is unable to manage their oral secretions. Mr. A's wife, she was now requesting that the physician get involved again and get another medication. She didn't know what was going on with her husband, but he continued coughing up bloody secretions into some tissues. The nurse did notify the physician at 2345, and a few minutes later, he came by and he was doing rounds. The nurse and the physician noted that he was sitting at the edge of the bed, he had shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, and they also noted that he had fullness in his throat, and he notably had anxiety. So with that, the physician thought, you know what, I'll give some lorazepam. Let's give some lorazepam for some immediate relief, and I think I'm gonna order a CAT scan. So he ordered a CAT scan of the neck, and you and I are thinking, okay, we wanna see what's in the neck. But in the medical record, he wrote, CAT scan ordered of the neck to rule out pulmonary embolism. Well, if you're wondering about pulmonary embolism, you should be doing a chest scan, not a neck scan. So that was a very interesting find when I reviewed the medical records. I was the nurse expert on this case. The physician documented in the medical record stating, the nurse called me to the bedside after midnight. The patient had ongoing neck pain and a mild cough. Well, it really wasn't a mild cough. Ativan was not helpful. Patient coughing, having throat pain. The radiology department called and said, okay, I want to confirm the orders. And then the next thing that happened is the nurse did confirm the orders. She noted in the medical record that the patient was whispering. The patient traveled to CAT scan. Now, when patients travel for a stat CAT scan, a nurse for the standard of care must travel with the patient. There was no licensed individual who traveled with the patient. It was a transport person. He was on oxygen, going down to CAT scan in a wheelchair. And he arrived down to the CAT scan, and they said, well, now we need you to actually stand up and transfer yourself over to the table. The exam prior to going downstairs noted that his oxygen saturations were in the 90s. They didn't note any stridor, and he was transferring over to have the study done, and he started coughing. Mr. A was coughing and coughing, and the next thing he did, he put his hands up to his neck and his throat. He whispered he couldn't breathe, and down he tumbled to the ground. The respiratory therapist was called stat to the CAT scan. A code was called. The patient was in distress. He had initially been coughing up mucus, holding the chest. The physician came, CPR was initiated, and unfortunately at this facility, they didn't really have on-call anesthesiologists, so they did try intubating him. There was a physician there, they got him to the emergency room, They couldn't intubate him successfully. They called 911. EMS came, and they attempted 3 additional times to intubate him. Unfortunately, the code was ended at 1:53 a.m. Very tragically, there is a cervical spine hematoma. And when you have a large hematoma, and I'm going to show you some photos, it actually displaced the trachea. So when you're you're trying to intubate a patient, and you now have a 90-degree turn of your trachea because the blood has pushed it to the side, you can't get a tube down there. And no one tried to do a trach. There was no other efforts that were done. So when we look at cervical spine complications, it's important to know what are normal and what is not normal. And also to keep these in mind, because while they can be normal, we want to trend them to see if there's any changes. And as a nurse, we can always increase our assessment times of our patients as well. So we may see sore throat, we talked about that. Difficulty swallowing and painful swallowing, we saw that here. Difficulty managing the secretions and drooling. Excessive secretions, swelling, orthopnea, which is difficulty breathing when you're lying down. You may see a change in the respiratory rate. You may have an increased rate, a change in the rhythm, shallow breathing, a change in depth, dyspnea. You may have coughing of the oral secretions or blood. In this case, Mr. A was stating he felt like he was choking to death. And he literally was. Breath sounds. Sometimes the breath sounds can change. You may have crackles, ronchi, wheezes, and hypoxia and cyanosis. Usually that's a later sign because as long as the airway is open, you're still getting good oxygen. So that's oftentimes a later sign. You may see stridor as the airway is narrowing. Phonation can change with an upper airway obstruction. You may have airway edema, agitation, anxiety. This gentleman was noted to be anxious, and that's why they were giving him lorazepam. He had a feeling of doom. He thought he was going to die. He had a change in his voice. He became whispery. Sometimes people can have hoarseness in their voice. When we talk about the standard of care, I refer to the American Nurses Association scope and standards of practice. First, I want to find out how many of you have actually read your Nurse Practice Act for your state? Okay, I'm impressed, a good amount. So I encourage all of you to read it, and while you may look at it and say, okay, why am I reading this? All Nurse Practice Acts actually incorporate the language of the nursing process. And that's really important when we talk about the standard of care. Because the standard of care does not require perfection. It's what a reasonably prudent nurse would do in the same or similar situation. Most errors don't cause harm. Consumers, who are our patients, they are entitled to the standard of care. It is what our nursing license is all about. If a patient is exposed to a medical error, then they are actually getting something less than what they're entitled to. And to them, they feel that they have an injustice on their hands, even if there was no harm. They feel like they've been wronged. So when we, as nurses, when we meet the standard of care, then we've met our burden in caring for our patients. And all of this helps decrease our risk. Again, standard of care is what a reasonably prudent nurse would do in the same or similar situation. When we talk about the American Nurses Association, scope and standards of practice, I like to think of it sort of like back in the days when we're doing English papers. The who, what, where, when, why, and how of a paper. And that is our nursing process. So our nursing process includes assessment, diagnosis, planning, implementation, and evaluation of the care that we've performed. What happens when things change? Well, most of our facilities were utilizing computerized medical records. Not all. So those of you who are on the computerized medical records, there's always drop-down boxes for us to add additional information. I've heard from nurses say, well, there were only certain check boxes that we could use. Well, if a patient's assessment changes, we can always include that additional information. Please remember to state what you're doing, what is the new information, or what is the change in the patient. Who specifically did you communicate with, and what is the new plan of care? It is expected that we are aware and know our policies and procedures for our facilities, that we understand and appreciate our nursing process, and every single one of us learned in nursing school, because it's part of all curriculums, what is the nursing process. And patient advocacy. We are charged as being nurses, as being patient advocates. And it's also required of us to know and utilize the chain of command. When we're caring for our patients, it's so important that we listen to our patients and we listen to the families. When we treat our patients, we can't just rely on numbers. So the nursing staff in Mr. A's case, they felt that because the oxygen saturation numbers were normal, they had a false sense of security. They're normal. He doesn't look like he's working that hard with his breathing. The respiratory rate was so-called normal, but look at all the other abnormal things that were going on. So as nurses, we can't dismiss the clinical picture. And it's so important for us to ask additional questions and communicate the findings and make a new plan of care. Mr. A's case was the perfect example of a failure to rescue. A failure to rescue, that's a general term now for all of us. It describes the outcome when a patient's condition deteriorates before the changes are recognized and acted upon. Failure to rescue is a major cause of mortality in acute care settings. Oftentimes, patients will exhibit signs and symptoms of an impending arrest as early as 72 hours prior to the arrest. So if we think here in Mr. A's case, look at how everything flowed, one symptom after another after another. And what he was stating of how he felt, and also his wife. I want to point out these photos here were of another individual, but I really, I was so happy to receive these photos. So this is actually a young woman in her 30s, and she had an anterior cervical surgery as well. She developed a postoperative hematoma, cervical spine hematoma. And one of the things people have asked me, they said, well, expect that I would see some golf ball size hematoma hanging off the neck, that I would be able to see that. But that's not so. You would actually, what happens is there's bleeding inside. You may see swelling on the outside. And here, you can see some swelling right around here. So it's not a golf ball size. I want to mention to you, 10 minutes after this photo was taken, she arrested and died. So I was so happy that the attorney that I was working with on another matter shared this and contacted her family to say these photos could help make a difference in the delivery of care of other patients, and thus I bring this to you. When we talk about failure to rescue, if you think about this case, it was a failure to recognize clinical deterioration, failure to communicate and escalate the concerns, failure to physically assess the patient, failure to diagnose and even treat possibly, appropriately. Other possibilities and other matters, sometimes it's organizational failure, there could be a lack of proper knowledge, failure to actually recognize that there's a clinical injury. Perhaps there's a lack of supervision, failure to get advice, and certainly in the matter that we just discussed, Mr. A, is failure to listen to the patient and the family. This is actually another individual, one of the orthopedic surgeons that I work with wanted to share this with me, and this was actually his patient. He was outside of the hospital. He had performed this cervical spine surgery. He called in to inquire about his patient. He heard the clinical signs and symptoms as red flags, knew that there must be a cervical spine hematoma, rushed into the hospital, brought this patient to surgery. If you take a look here, the swelling here. This is post-op. It was pre-op, bring the patient right into the OR. There's the hematoma, got the patient in, removed the blood, and the patient lived, and there were no adverse events that occurred. So timing was so important. This is actually a slide of the pathology of Mr. A's case. I wish I had a picture showing the deviated trachea, but I do have a segment of the autopsy for you to see. So if you see here, that whole area, that's the hematoma, and that was actually underneath, totally displacing the trachea. Oops. There's two photos. Here's one more. The autopsy showed the victim died as the result of an acute upper airway obstruction due to an occlusive intraluminal laryngeal thrombus with extensive neck soft tissue bleeding, complicating the cervical spine fusion. The extent and the nature of the cervical bleed exerted a compressive force of the laryngeal tracheal structures. So true displacement. This next segment, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about audit logs and audit trails. So the electronic medical record is very complex, and it tracks everything that we do and everything that we look at as well, no matter how simple or complex. And every action that you do leaves a digital fingerprint. So as you're aware, the medical record may have different sites to document the information. And some sites can be, you know, maybe you're double documenting. And so you're picking and choosing where you want to put your vital signs. So the vital signs during the code could be on the code sheet. Sometimes people put them on the vital sign sheet, or they may be in the nurse's note, or they may be in a drop-down box. So there's a variety of places with regard to documenting. Audit logs can be used in litigation because they actually help bolster or they can refute a claim that the procedures were performed at the times that the physician or the nurse stated that they were performed. It's the audit logs are metadata, and they're key to proving what was going on with the patient and if there were ever any changes made in the medical record. Audit trails are used for security purposes to determine who's logged onto the medical record. And I'm sure many of you have seen in the media, there have been times that maybe a famous person was in a hospital and the nursing staff wanted access to their information and maybe shared it with their friends. There was a famous, you know, let's say an actress was in there and they wanted to share the information. So all of that information as to who actually accessed that, and certainly it wasn't their patient, many nurses have been fired for that. So we can't do that. Those are HIPAA violations. When I review a medical record, I like to put together a chronology to help capture the data. The audit logs, they will actually reveal who entered the chart, what actual segments of the chart were entered and reviewed, the length of time that a page was opened, were there any modifications, addendums, deletions in the medical record, time that the notes were entered. Also, there are times when people are cutting and pasting. And I encourage you not to cut and paste. I've seen it with nursing notes. I've seen it with physician notes. And unfortunately, data is carried from one day to the next. And you're looking saying, wait a minute, this isn't the assessment of the patient. This is days old. We're looking at something new here. You haven't captured the new information. Timestamps, such as July 1, 2018 at 08:42 and 01 Eastern Standard Time, would be something that we would take a look at of a timestamp. We would look at the medical record number to find out if it actually matches that patient. There have been times that people have gone into the wrong records, maybe of somebody with the same name on the unit, and a note has been made accidentally in one chart versus the other. Then you go back and you write error, wrong patient. So something as simple as writing that, you're acknowledging you wrote on the wrong patient. We also have access to finding out the actual computer that was utilized and how many seconds a document was up for. I actually was an expert in, I'll tell you a quick story of a patient who, he was a 30-year-old, he went into the hospital, he fell off his ladder, and he had a radial and ulnar fracture. While he was in the hospital, he had his surgical procedure, had the fixation, bait screws, everything was lovely. But post-op, he became a little bit unstable, vital signs were changing, and his hematocrit, which started at a 43, was trending down, 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 down. They couldn't figure out, well, why was it trending down? Let's, check it again. So we're down at 27, 21, 16. The nursing staff then had him, tilted the bed up. We're giving him IV fluids. They were contacting the physician, saying, something's not right with this patient. You need to come up. Vital signs are going down. We think there's going to be, some type of code situation. We want you to be aware of the following with the lab results. And unfortunately, that gentleman coded. He had a laceration of his liver and spleen that was not recognized, and he died. The physician testified stating that it was all the nurse's fault because they never notified him with any of the information. I was actually the plaintiff expert, and so I was talking about the standard of care that was breached with the nurses. But the nursing staff was pretty uniform. They all kept saying, no, we did tell the doctor. Well, as an expert, I can't dismiss that. I have to listen to what they're saying. So I then suggested to the attorney, I want a full audit trail. I want you to find out what computers were utilized. And we were able to find out, yes, indeed, they did tell that doctor. Not only in their notes, they said that they had informed the doctor, and it was a he said, she said. But we had proof now. So he was in the operating room. He actually pulled it up on the computer. When the nursing staff contacted him, he actually had that page of the labs up for 90 seconds in the operating room. So that was great for us. While I'm on the plaintiff's side, yes, the nurses absolutely did communicate that forward. So that certainly helped them because they were doing what they needed to do with that. But here, something is as simple as finding out what computer somebody was on. It was very helpful to them. So we look at who viewed or entered anything in the medical record. Were the entries modified or deleted? You may think that when you go in and you erase something, when we have an audit trail, we can go in and we can see what was done. Was the entry reported to be done? Example, a heart rate. And maybe later somebody put a note in 3 days later, but they try to make it look like that day that the assessment was done. How is the entry made? Was it on a flow sheet or was it done manually? So this is Mr. A's medical record, and this is part of the audit trail that I thought would be very helpful for you to see. In this case, I mentioned to you that the nurse testified she never listened to the patient's breath sounds, yet she documented they were clear. So right here is the time that is, there's usually a word up here, it says assessment. So 2100 was her assessment and her documentation time was 338. Now I realize we try to do our best and document as close to time as possible, but this was clearly hours after the patient coded. And we know she didn't even check the breath sounds, and she's documenting everything is here as normal. We also found that she documented at the front desk, and she was documenting all her notes, similar times. So here, this is Mr. A. And you can see here the various times that the nurse was documenting in his, stating the assessment time. She assessed at 1900, 2030, 2200, 05. But I want you to see this. Okay, 2:10, 4 a.m., 6 a.m., granted there's nothing there. And the times that these notes were written, 6:23, 6:25, 27, 28, 29. Well, this patient died at 1:53 in the morning. So how can you do an assessment? Tell me that his assessment at 2:10, 4 o'clock, and 6 a.m. And those assessments, breath sounds, everything was normal. This nurse had four patients, and so she had, so I point out to you that at 2200, 1, 2, 3, so she said that she did an assessment. She was in three patients' rooms at 2200. Well, no, we can only be with one patient at one time, and these are different rooms. And then at 2 a.m., she said she was with two patients in their rooms, yet we know that this patient had coded. I would think that she would have been with him for a period of time and then with his family. So when there's multiple entries showing the same time that care has been delivered, it demonstrates and questions the integrity and the accuracy of the medical record. This is actually a picture of Mr. A, another one of him. His family was so happy that I was able to share with you. He loved to fish. He had a grandchild. He was really fun guy, from what I hear from the family through the attorney that I was working with. I like to include this because it just pulls together a patient picture and humanizes a story. They believed that there were deviations in care, and if they did, whose fault was it that this patient died? The jury deliberated for a short period of time, and they made the decision that they assigned a portion means fault, 90% fault to the nursing staff, 90% to the nursing staff, and then 10% to the physician in the hospital. I think this clicker has a little mind of its own here. There are several reasons that we are expected to document within the medical record. The medical record is the one area where all healthcare providers have the opportunity to review what's going on with the patient, what's the patient's health history, what's going on with him, what's going on not only during your shift, but the shift prior, what is the plan of care that's going to go on with the patient. And it's also our opportunity as nurses to compare assessments. We get report, we go in and assess our patients, we may see that there's something different. It's the expectation that we're gonna compare the prior assessment with our new assessment. Did the condition improve? Did it get worse? The medical record is a legal document, and it's when a patient's health, you know, obviously, all of that is there for us to review and to participate in. It is the most important in a malpractice case, and it's the place where it demonstrates if we met the standard of care as well. It's very important that if we, when we go in to do our assessments of our patients, and if we find that there are any changes, that we document what those changes are. The medical record should reflect all the phases of the nursing process. So while there may be a physician order that states, do vital signs, neurovascular signs, let's say it said every 4 hours, and if you saw a change, we don't need a physician order to tell us to go and reassess our patients. There have been many times that nurses have stated, well, the doctor said every 8 hours, so that means I don't have to check on the patient again. That's not true at all. What is the standard of care? What a reasonably prudent, careful nurse would do in the same or similar situation. So we have a change in an assessment. It's our responsibility and duty to go and reassess our patients. And not only that, we reassess them, we're documenting, we're communicating those changes forward, we're updating our plan of care. There are times that we're utilizing chain of command, and certainly it's very important for us to advocate for our patients. It's very important for us to understand the physician orders that have been written. We act as patient advocates for the patient. So if an order looks inappropriate, make sure you question that order. There have been times that physicians go into a medical record and they may write an order. For example, an order has been written for administration of metoprolol, you know, give this med every 6 hours. Well, perhaps that patient that you have doesn't have a cardiac issue. Why was the medication written? Maybe it was written on the wrong patient. So we have to understand all the reasons why we're administering medication for a patient. When we are charting, it's very important that we have complete notes versus incomplete notes, and making sure that they're timely. Now, while we do our best to document at the time, you know, close to the care being delivered, we know that sometimes it could be a few hours later that we're entering things into the medical record. But it's certainly not acceptable days later to go back in and document after an event and putting something in there and trying to make it look like it happened at that time. How many of you, aside from having the computerized documentation, how many of you actually have some paper charts as well? A few. So at my facility, while we are computerized medical records, we do have some charts that have some paper documents in there. And it could be consents for surgery, maybe the case manager put something in there. There may be some documents in there. So making sure that things are entered into the right patient's chart is certainly very important. Making sure it's timely, it's legible as well. When we enter our notes into the medical records, I encourage you to avoid bias. Many plaintiff attorneys who actually screen medical malpractice cases, they will hear complaints from, you know, individuals saying, you know, the nurse didn't like me, you know, there was antagonism there at the bedside, and when the attorneys or others are looking at the medical record, the nurse may have used the following words. The patient was a complainer. The patient was drunk, abusive, lazy. The patient was a spoiled brat. This was a real problem patient. This patient was demanding. This patient was obnoxious and nasty. These are terms that are in the medical records. Or the patient was disagreeable. So if a jury reads those words, they may infer that maybe the patient actually received substandard care. Maybe there's been judgment by the healthcare provider into that medical record. So, for example, instead of charting that the patient was obnoxious, maybe we should describe the specific behavior of the patient. The patient was swearing. The patient was verbally abusive. The patient was demanding constant attention. the patient was, you know, so maybe document what are the acts, what's actually occurring with the patient versus judgment of the patient. There are times that we may have patients that are non-compliant as well. And patients have responsibilities as well. We can't, you know, as nurses, we know that they have responsibilities, and as patients, we try to talk to them about those responsibilities. They have responsibilities to provide, you know, certainly we do, to provide the proper information, but they have responsibilities to inform us of information as well. They have responsibilities to actually follow the instructions of the healthcare team and to ask questions if they fail to follow instructions. You know, it's really important that they follow our directions, that we encourage dialogue and ask them to ask us questions. Certainly, if a patient is refusing care or treatment, it's most important that we document that in the medical record and that we communicate that also to the physician. What if the patient is refusing medications? Again, we would document that, communicate that forward. If the patient is not staying in bed when they're on strict bed rest, well, we have to know, is the patient alert and oriented? Are they somebody who's confused? Do they have delirium or dementia? Then sometimes patients don't remember. But for those individuals who are alert and oriented and they're refusing to stay in bed, it's really important that we document that they are refusing this and that we're talking to them further about it. Maybe they're failing to adhere to the dietary restrictions. They're a diabetic and they're eating two pieces of fudge. Maybe they're on a clear liquid diet, but they decided they wanted to eat a hamburger before, you know, a few hours before going to surgery. That's being non-compliant. What if they are making a decision that they want to sign up against medical advice? Well, all hospitals have policies with regard to that, with regard to documenting, explaining to the patients why they need to remain in the hospital, having the physician come and talk to the patient, and trying to provide additional information to them, and hopefully they certainly won't leave. We had a situation in our facility, this was several years ago, of a 19-year-old who he lost his arm due to a machete fight. And it was an above the arm amputation. Our physicians spent about 26, 27 hours in the operating room reattaching that arm. Post-op, we were monitoring him very closely and certainly doing neurovascular assessments. And I mean, they were like every 15 minutes, every half hour, every hour, really watching him closely. And things were progressing well. He actually, at the bedside, I saw him, he moved his fingers. That was amazing. And he actually had a little sensation, still very numb, but things were looking. Couple days later, he was a big smoker on the night shift. He was going out to smoke. And the nursing staff was talking to me. We don't want you going out to smoke. You can't go out and smoke. It's going to narrow your vessels. You're going to risk losing your arm. He said, I can do what I want. I'm an adult. I can do what I want. You can't make me stay here. The nursing staff did call security to come up, and security said, well, he's 19 years old. He's made decisions. He's allowed to make his own decisions. The physicians came down and talked to him and said, please, you know, please don't go out and smoke. You're going to risk losing your arm. We reattached it. He repeatedly was going out, and sadly, to see his arm change color and turn black. And several days later, he went and had an amputation. It was so sad for all of us as nurses to watch that. We had social services involved, trying to bring his family in, trying to talk to him, had psych talk to him. We had lots of people talking to him, and it didn't matter to him. I mean, he just stated, I don't care if I lose my arm. And that was so sad that a cigarette was more important than his arm. So I share that. exfoliation of medical records is an actual or attempted destruction or suppression and tampering of material evidence. There are times that medical records are actually altered. And if a medical record is altered and there's an issue and proof that the medical record has been altered, it could be the holy grail of discovery. I have had, I had a particular case that neurovascular assessments, the physician knew that they were in the medical record. He said that he saw them the morning that the patient was actually going to lose their limb and said there were very few neurovascular assessments done. When we reviewed the record, those records weren't there. During trial, it was discovered by one of the defendant nurses when he was asked, did you do neurovascular assessments? Yes. Well, where did you document it? On the neurovascular form. Okay. When did you last see it? Just this year. What do you mean just this year? Now, the incident had happened 3 years prior. What do you mean just this year? Oh, yes. Well, where did you see it? When I met with the risk manager, she had the neurovascular forms. They had been removed. So needless to say, that ended up playing a role in the jury verdict and punitive damages. When we're documenting in the medical records, it's important that we document in full, that we tell a full color story, not just a black and white story about the patient. If we're documenting, we're doing our assessments, making sure that our vital signs there, that our assessments, our head to toe, front to back assessments are documented, because certainly days later is not the time to go in and document. Please avoid adding to anyone else's notes. There have been times individuals have received codes to go into a nurse's note. Perhaps the nurse went home. She said, oh my gosh, I forgot to write this. Can you go in and access the note and add these additional things? Please don't do that. You know, certainly if somebody forgot to add information, they should either come back in, or if they're doing a late note the next day, they should enter it late entry and put the reason why there's a late entry. There are times that when I talk about spoliation of evidence that I mentioned before, we can detect tampering within the medical record. And we can see what the flow is in the medical record and if something was randomly put in days later or maybe months later. I've seen things that have even been inserted 2 years later. And how did you remember 2 years later what the vital signs were for that day or what the patient looked like or the specific time or who you called or what was done? And it was a beautiful look like everything was normal, and we know nothing was normal in that particular situation. When we look at tampering too, when I look at medical records, say a patient was in the hospital and then went to the rehab or some other place, we are going to compare the condition of what was the patient in the hospital, let's say a bed sore. Did the patient have decubitus in the hospital? Did they have it upon entry to the rehab? So I've looked at things that patients have arrived at a rehab and all of a sudden you're looking at a decubitus ulcer on the sacrum, on the heels, and it's absent from the medical record. But upon arrival, it's there. So it didn't happen in the ambulance ride across town. We know that, obviously, it was there in the hospital. It's important that we do it when we do our assessments. We do our front to back, head to toe assessments, especially on those patients that are just admitted to us, but truly for all patients. Because if a patient comes from another facility or if they come from it and is noted days later, your facility owns it. When we look at paper records, and there still are some out there, and we look at obliterations, do you think that we can't see what's behind here? Try to guess, what is the word that is behind here? Somebody's crossing out because they don't want us to know. Or somebody may use whiteout for us not to see. Well, guess what? We can see it with an x-ray. He said knee. This is a particular case that I worked on that a patient had been unfortunately not diagnosed with a T8 fracture. Patient was having a lot of pain. The CAT scans actually showed the fracture, and for whatever reason, the physicians and the nursing staff were pretty unaware. Patient was having 10 out of 10 pain. It was an older person, and they were given 10 milligrams of IV morphine. The nurse came in, and there were, if you can see this yellow box here, no neurovascular assessments upon the time of the nurse seeing the patient in the morning until later in the day when the patient was noted to be paralyzed. And the patient was noted to be paralyzed initially by the physical therapist. When we look at malpractice cases, the vast majority of them, they require an expert to actually articulate the standard of care. And we've already discussed the standard of care. I want to give you time for questions. So there's a duty owed to the patient. So when we're caring for a patient, it's established when the healthcare provider agrees to actually take care of the patient. Breach of duty is the negligent departure of that. Was there a failure to recognize the known or commonly known complications? Was there an injury? And did this injury cause the long-lasting effects? When we look at terminology, the plaintiff is the person who's actually filing the lawsuit, alleging that he or she was wrong. The defendant is the one accused of the wrongdoing. Malpractice is negligence by a professional that caused an injury, and negligence is the failure to act as a reasonable person. This is in your handouts, which you should be able to get after this session. When we care for patients, you've heard the term critical thinking. It's made up of reasoning, problem solving, and evaluating. When we look at the three top factors in failure to rescue, have to do with failing to recognize the early signs of deterioration, assessing, planning, and communicating. Failing to follow the standards of care, actually failing to use the equipment in a responsible manner. One of the matters that I worked on was a patient who's supposed to be receiving IV heparin. The delivery system kept beeping and beeping, and the nurse kept pressing override, override, override. The patient got 25,000 units of heparin in 34 minutes, had a massive bleed in the brain, and died. So obviously failure to use the equipment as intended. Other theories of liability include failing to act as a patient advocate, which we talked about. And then when we talk about how are accidents happening, many of you have heard the term Dr. Reason's Swiss cheese model. And Lucian Leap worked on the initiative back in 1998 that discussed how many thousands of people were dying as a result of medical errors. So what they did was they developed this model and putting different pieces of Swiss cheese together. So if we look here, we have Mr. A in the case that we're talking about, and here we have the arrow going through. Each of these holes here is a deviation in the nursing standard of care or the physician standard of care. So depending on what we're looking at for a case. So, and then we can identify on here, add more pieces. You know, the nursing staff was failing to assess, failing to communicate. You know, there's many things that we've already talked about with that matter. So when we talk about communicating, whether it's to our peers, whether it's to the physicians, it's important that we communicate, that we tell a full story. Not just the black and white story, the basics, the bones, but tell a full color story. And that way, a plan of care can be appropriately updated. So I want to share with you just a couple foibles that to end this that was actually written in some medical records, the following. Patient is able to remove his neck, but it does cause him some discomfort. Discharge status, alive but without permission. The patient requests an autopsy. The doctor came up and did a pelvic on the floor. So with that, if any of you have any questions, I welcome you to come up to to the microphone. If I can answer any of your questions. And here's my contact information. Oh, those are the references. Okay. Yes. Thank you.
I really appreciated what you shared about how the EMR does an electronic audit and the differences between when we say we did our assessment and when we're actually adding the information into the EMR. And I know where I work, there are some pretty rigid expectations. Assessments would be done every 4 hours, every two, whatever. And I find that may be driving nurses to want to say, I did my assessment between 8 and 9, even if they weren't able to do that, because they're going to get dinged in terms of hospital standards, not necessarily standard of care. And I wondered if you might have any advice for nurses that might be working under similar situations about how they can defend always doing real-time documentation and talking to their administrators that are evaluating them. Because there's like conflict of interest there.
There is, and everybody's assignment and acuity levels of patients and whether you're at a major facility or a small community hospital, the standards remain the same, whether I'm here or whether I'm in Boston or a small community facility. So it's great if we can document in real time. That doesn't always happen. And I do encourage our staff, as well as I do it myself when I'm caring for my patients. I want to touch base. I come in, I get report, and I want to touch base with all my patients right off the bat, just to, you know, some people do bedside report. That's becoming much more common across the country. It's not everywhere, though. Then if you're doing bedside report, then you are noticing with the prior nurse, what is the assessment of the patient? Were there any changes? Do you have any questions? But if you're not at the going and touching base with that patient and then circumventing back around, so you're going to see all your patients, then you're coming back, doing your assessments, and starting and going. So, if you're taking a report at 7, if you're in the room at 7:15, or you take a report a little bit earlier, so you still have that window of time to meet that you've seen your patient, towards the beginning of the shift, and then following up with your assessments. I would hope, too, that we would prioritize our patients, who needs to be seen first. If you have a critical patient, I would hope that you're going to go see that patient first before you see perhaps your stable patients, because you want to touch base if somebody had a rocky night or a change in vital signs, change in neurovascular assessment. You're going to need to know what's going on right then and there to then best handle what you need to do with the rest of your assignment. There are times that things happen at shift change, and maybe there's a rapid response team, maybe there's something going on, maybe your colleagues need to cover some of your patients for you because you're dealing with this emergency, or maybe you have to take your patient off the floor to go to CAT scan and somebody has to cover for you. So I'm not sure if I answered that in full, but seeing your patients at the beginning of your shift and prioritizing the care will definitely help you with driving your day forward and assessing. Thanks.
First of all, I'm going to say I've had 2 ACDFs, so like the anterior cervical third, so that's terrifying to me. I'm grateful that I didn't have any of those complications. But one thing, I also have a child with an airway defect, so just as a reminder to everybody, O2 sets are not necessarily a guarantee that the patient is actually receiving enough oxygen. But you can always put your stethoscope on the upper airway to hear a slight wheeze that you may not hear in the lungs, so just as a suggestion to people. Second of all, my facility actually recently, a couple years ago, transitioned into what we call EBCD, so evidence-based clinical documentation, to where we actually document by exception. What is a way that one nurse could, in that situation, there's not as many fields to document excess things. How would one go about protecting themselves in these situations with that type of documentation?
So document by exception is certainly an acceptable way to document. Many facilities do that in the United States. But the requirement is still to do an assessment at the beginning of your shift and documenting that assessment. So we can't just rely on the prior shift's assessment. It's still expected that we document that assessment. Then, if we are seeing changes, then we'll be going back into that person's chart and documenting what those changes are. And how do we update the plan of care? And who came? So that's really important with the document by exception, because if we don't, you know, if you're writing the norm and no one ever put anything else in there, and then we later find out something happened, well, we know that the patient didn't remain normal, so-called normal, all day long. Base case that everything, breath sounds were normal. And I appreciate your comment, so true to use the stethoscope and to be, you know, certainly we can listen on their neck as well. You can hear the stridor sometimes from their mouth, or you can hear it sometimes with the stethoscope, so thank you.
Hi, my question is regarding to the RT. During the discussion, you mentioned that the RT came to the unit twice to assess the patient, but there was no responsibility given to the RT during the trial. What are the roles of the RT on a unit like that, and what are the reasons why there was no mention of the RT's involvement during the trial?
Thank you, great question. So the respiratory therapist was not so-called named during this case. That was a legal strategy by the attorneys, but they also felt that the respiratory therapist was part of the hospital. So the hospital paid 10%, which was physician and anybody, other entities in the hospital. But the primary surgeon, so the person who was on call at night was the physician that had the 10% with. That would also include the respiratory therapist as part of the hospital. The surgeon himself was not included in that. It was 0% fault because he wasn't aware. He wasn't there. Nobody called him. Thank you. But there are expectations of respiratory therapists for sure, but they didn't really highlight too much about that. I think they were really focused because as things moved along and all the complaints, you know, what else is being done? Who's coming to see the patient? Are there any other questions? Yes. I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We work on a joint and spine center, so we see lots of ACVs. If we happen to make patient notes along with the assessment, are patient notes part of the chart for when you go to court?
When you say patient notes, are you entering in the medical record?
Yes.
Are you talking? Oh, yes, of course, yes.
Okay.
So we will have the paper record, and we will have the computerized medical record as well. We'll have all of that.
Like, for example, you say, you know, notice change in patient, called MD, who you talked to, what they told you to do. That goes with it?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
How is this verified?
But don't just write MD. Write the doctor's name.
Yeah.
If you try to really make a conscious effort as to
right.
Which physician are you calling. Because, you know, if there's ever a question of a case, you know, 3, 4, 5 years later,
yeah.
You may not remember the name of the doctor, but if you actually put it in the record, you know, it's there. You've already communicated.
Okay.
And what did you communicate? And what was his response?
Right. Whether he ordered something or just
exactly.
Said to watch the patient.
Exactly. I mean, look here. There's a CAT scan that was ordered up in the neck to look for a pulmonary embolism.
Right.
Which it didn't quite make sense.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else?
In your experience, how much did the knowledge that at least one nurse falsified the medical record impact that jury in assigning 90% of the fault to the nurses? Mr. A's record, they went back and after he was dead, entered assessments, so clearly the medical record was falsified. And so, I'm assuming the jury heard that information.
So they did hear it. It really wasn't, so it was put out to the jury for them to see, but I don't think that it was put out there that she was so-called falsifying it.
Well,
you know,
the
yes.
jury should be able to figure that out.
Exactly. You know, seeing that the assessments were done, you know,
after he died.
After he passed away. But there was so much to focus on during the time. It wasn't so much the after. I wasn't there for all of that. As an expert, I'm only allowed to be in there when I'm testifying. Mm-hmm. I was able to obtain the follow-up information from the attorney. But it can make a difference depending upon what court you're in, for sure.
Good morning. I had a question about that actual case too, where it said that nursing was 90% responsible. Did that mean that specific nurse, or was it charge nurse, nurse manager, the whole nursing department on that unit, nursing in general?
So in that case, the nurses were not named as individuals. It was nurses with the hospital. So it was the nursing. So when the verdict came out, they assigned the fault 90% to the nurses. So that would come from, you know, I don't know how they collect their money. Is their insurer, not the individual nurse's insurer, but the hospital for the nurse's insurer. Thank you. Well, I'll be here for a few minutes if anybody has any additional questions, and I thank you so much for coming.